Welcome to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Weekly Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann this morning. Republicans in the U.S. Senate have revised their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. John Kasich does not like it. Sherrod Brown does not like it. And Rob Portman, he's kind of undecided at this point. The new Senate plan offers smaller tax cuts. It allows some leeway for insurance companies to offer skimpier, cheaper health insurance plans. It would spend $45 billion for opioid addiction treatment, and it keeps some Obamacare taxes on high earners. The bill still has significant cuts to Medicaid, and that's where the problem lies for Ohio politicians and leaders. Joining us on this Game of Thrones free weekly roundtable is State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchard. Welcome, Jackie.
Good morning.
State government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Balmert. Jesse, welcome.
Hello.
And public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch and Game of Thrones aficionado, Daryl Rowland.
Yeah, sure, Mike.
Anyway, that's the most overexposed story of the week, next to Donald Trump's emails and, of course, the health care plan, which is what we'll talk about today. Of course, the news today is that U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he will delay consideration of the health care legislation in the U.S. Senate. Ironically, I guess you could say, because one of the key senators, John McCain from Arizona, has a health issue. He had surgery over the weekend or the past few days for a blood clot above his eye. It'll take at least a week for him to recover. So the U.S. Senate, with no votes to spare, cannot stand to lose even one senator who is out sick. So Jackie Borchard, Rob Portman is a key swing vote in this. Two Republican senators have said they will not support it. So no other Republicans can say no to keep this bill alive. And Rob Portman is one of the key swing votes.
Right. With two votes, that takes it to 50-50. And then, you know, Vice President Mike Pence can easily break that tie. But yeah, anyone in addition to that, and John McCain, although he has highly, you know, criticized both of these versions of the Senate bill, hopefully they, you know, we're hoping to get his vote. So I think the fact that they've put it off shows that there's quite a few questioning it. And Rob Portman is in that mix. He has not come down so far since late last week on either side. He says he wants to see what the impact might be, wait for the Congressional Budget Office score on the impact. But there are some things in this bill that Senate leaders tried to appease moderates like Portman. The extra opioid funding, which is $45 billion. However, that's over 10 years,
yep,
which comes out to $4.5 billion a year divided by 50 states. You know, is that enough? And Portman's not the only one who was, you know, hoping for something like that. So we'll see.
Daryl Rowland, a week's delay in this vote. Is that good news or bad news for folks like Rob Portman who are facing pressure from both sides?
You know, if you love protests, if you love people calling your office, man, it's great news. Otherwise, yeah. I don't know. Senator Portman, former OMB Director Portman, former U.S. Trade Representative, you know, he is one of these guys who likes to get in the weeds of some of these policy debates. I take him at his word. He wants to look at that Congressional Budget Office score, which now may be a little bit delayed since the urgency is not quite there.
Yeah.
Might be a couple of weeks yet before that vote. You know, he wants to look that over. Now, the logical question for him, however, he opposed the first bill because of how it treated people on Medicaid. It treats people on Medicaid exactly the same in this bill. Now, as Jackie mentioned, there's the sweetener of the $45 billion in opioid treatment. Okay, that, you know, again, do the math. That's, as Governor Kasich has famously put it, that's a spit in the ocean. Would that be enough to carry the day for Senator Portman? That's kind of where we're at now. He was asked that, and his only answer was two words: "We'll see."
Yeah, we're not there yet. I think is one of the quote he said coming out of the meeting. So there is room for possibly some negotiation there. Jesse Balmert from the Cincinnati Inquirer. As Daryl said, the Medicaid cuts are still there. $800 billion mm-hmm. in Medicaid cuts. It seems like the Republican leadership in the U.S. Senate cannot have a bill that includes more Medicaid money without losing the far right. folks like, well, they've already lost Rand Paul, but people like Ted Cruz and people like that, they don't want any more Medicaid money in this bill.
Yeah, I think it's a delicate balance for the Republicans in the Senate because there is such a diversity of opinions. You start swinging too far one way and you lose the people who, you know, don't consider this an entitlement program and are just opposed to it outright, and you swing too far the other way and, you know, you lose people on the other end. So that's a concern. And I think Rob Portman, who is kind of in the middle here, partially because he comes from a state like Ohio and partially because he has, you know, John Kasich talking every other second about the concerns about Medicaid, he is in a position where he is kind of going to be approached by both sides. And so he being a maybe is actually almost a more powerful position for Rob Portman to be in right now as far as negotiations.
How much of an influence does John Kasich and his position on this have on Rob Portman's vote?
I mean, I'm sure it doesn't make Rob Portman's job any easier having a vocal governor back home. I think it's something that he's always going to be questioned about. Well, you know, John Kasich is concerned about this. What about you? But I do think this is something that Rob Portman personally is concerned about. He ran last year a lot on his ability to tackle the drug addiction problem. And he had a pretty this CARA bill that he put a lot of money or allowed the allocation of a lot of money towards addiction treatment. So this is an issue that he has been interested in, and cutting healthcare could cut services to drug treatment. So it's, you know, he's kind of in a rough spot.
John Kasich, Jackie, said that the Medicaid cuts are too deep. He also says it does not do enough to stabilize the insurance market. What does he mean by that?
Well, I mean, look, in Ohio, next year we're looking at, almost 20 counties that aren't going to have an insurer on the Obamacare exchange. And that's an issue that's, you know, playing out in other states. And there's been a couple ideas kind of thrown around to see what can be done on that front. Now, the Senate bill puts some money directly to insurers. I believe it's $180 or so billion. And some experts have said that's not nearly enough of what's needed. And interestingly enough, Alaska just arranged a deal with the Trump administration that had been previously approved by the Obama administration, where the feds are sending money to Alaska to pay for these high risk – to insure high risk folks, you know, the people who are already have hefty, you know, pre-existing conditions and require a lot of expensive care. And in the meanwhile, they're cutting – That's enabling them to cut premiums for everybody. And so while the feds are, you know, giving a direct dollar amount to the state by lowering premiums, the feds are paying less in those subsidies in Obamacare. So that's one thing that some people are looking at to see maybe that could, you know, work out around the country. However, that still props up Obamacare.
It's still money.
It's still money, right. But it's money that would have been in the subsidies is what I'm saying. So It's kind of like a wash. But that supports the continuation of Obamacare. And, you know, Republicans for the last 8 years have been saying we need to get rid of this. We need to get rid of this. And that's what these bills are supposed to be addressing.
We're talking about the U.S. Senate's revised health care bill with our reporter roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can submit a question on the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Daryl, there's been a concerted effort on the part of the Trump administration to pressure, quote, moderate Republicans like Rob Portman, John Kasich to buy into this. And Mike Pence, speaking at the governor's convention in Rhode Island this weekend, quoted apparently a Wall Street Journal editorial that says that there are 60,000 Ohioans who can't get Medicaid because of the state's decision to expand the program. Your paper and you have been pretty vocal in saying that's not true at all.
Right. And it's a conflation of a couple of things, Mike. And frankly, that's part of the reason what makes this discussion hard, because it is, as our president discovered himself, it is complicated.
Yes, it is.
there is a list of roughly 60,000 Ohioans waiting for care. Most of them are developmentally disabled, some intellectually disabled. There's some aged population in that as well. But those are through what they call the DD population, developmentally disabled. Now, the reason some people think this is a this is like a Medicaid waiting list is because they need Medicaid waivers to obtain treatment. It's not that easy. These are run through counties, and there are existing slots, and like Franklin County's slots are full, and there are indeed waiting lists of up to years for some of these people, often kids on the autism spectrum or what have you. When Ohio people say there is no waiting list for Medicaid services, they're talking about the traditional, like on the Medicaid expansion. There's no wait to get on that. But what was really factually incorrect in Vice President Pence's statements was linking the two, that Medicaid expansion, instead of funding all these kids or old folks or the disabled on these waiting lists, they decide to use the money to expand Medicaid instead. And that's just simply not true. And that's not just me. The Kaiser Foundation has backed that up. The Kaiser Foundation, they're basically the source of that 60,000 number. But they also put out a study saying there is no relationship. There was that kind of a waiting list beforehand, and there is now. The Medicaid expansion funding until very recently was 100% funding. So it wasn't like the state could even use that money to draw down that waiting list. Vice President Pence has backed off that statement now, although his spokesman says, well, yeah, I wasn't really trying to connect the two, which itself is a dubious statement. But yeah. I think we'll leave it rest.
There has been talk that the expansion of Medicaid, Jesse, has put pressure on hospitals and maybe not everyone can be served. Is there any evidence of that happening around the state, that because you've added 700,000 people to the Medicaid rolls, that other folks, so they can't get a doctor's appointment as quickly or can't get services as quickly? Is that happening at all?
I'm trying to think. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I haven't studied that issue specifically, but I know the Ohio Hospital Association is a strong supporter of Medicaid expansion. And for a lot of hospitals in the rural areas, this is, money that they are getting now that they previously weren't in uncompensated care. So, if any of my colleagues can speak.
I've heard this talking point, but I wasn't sure if there's any evidence to back it up.
Yeah, I think, what I've heard more of is what Jesse said, that the hospitals are relying on this expansion funding to not only, run their current operations, but to expand and build new facilities. You can argue whether that they should be doing that with expansion dollars, with the help they're getting from the expansion. But, I mean, that would lead to increased opportunities to provide care, not fewer.
The $45 billion for opioid addiction treatment, Daryl, we've done the math, $4.5 billion a year over 50 states. Is that enough, not just politically, but is that enough to help this problem here in Ohio?
Well, I mean, I did the math, and it's, if you have to make some arbitrary assumptions, and assuming, as we said, all 50 states are going to get a piece of the pie. I did it just based on the share you get population. So Ohio would get the seventh most of the money. And that comes out to like, I don't know, $160 million a year. We're spending $1 billion a year. So compared to that, it is, as the governor says, a spit in the ocean, I guess. On the other hand, it is a 16% increase. And frankly, that's more than the governor himself proposed with his budget. So I don't know.
Yeah, you pointed that out yesterday, is that here's the governor criticizing the lack of federal funds. But when his budget came out, it didn't really increase opiate funding as much as the legislature did. Now, he argues that Medicaid expansion has done a lot to help the opiate crisis.
Well, that's no question. And when we talk about Ohio as devoting $1 billion a year to the drug fight, a large majority of that is the Medicaid expansion money. So as far as state funds, if you will, there's not been, relatively speaking, that much. And you're right. But, the House added some, the Senate added some more, conference committee, they came out with more money than the governor proposed.
Which is true. I mean, the governor keeps coming back to this. Medicaid expansion was his solution to drug treatment for this opioid and heroin problem that the state is having. But obviously, we still have this problem. So if Medicaid expansion solved it, it didn't, but certainly it helped.
And Jackie, that wasn't the reason in the beginning why the governor expanded Medicaid. That wasn't one of the his was he wanted to help people in the shadows, people dealing with mental illness. Addiction, it was part of it, but wasn't the number one reason why he expanded Medicaid.
Right. I think that's a reason that has emerged after the Department of Medicaid did a pretty thorough survey of who, you know, is actually receiving care through the expansion. And that's where they're getting some of the extrapolation of these numbers, and that, you know, nearly half are receiving treatment for mental illness, addiction, behavioral health. So, you know, that wasn't the primary driver, but it's been the effect of it for sure.
We're talking about health care, the latest on the efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare in the U.S. Senate, and how it might affect Ohio politics and how it might affect Ohioans. We'll continue the discussion when All Sides with Ann Fisher continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's the weekly reporter's roundtable. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Joining us, Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jesse Balmert, State Government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Daryl Rowland, Public Affairs Editor of the Columbus Dispatch. Continuing on our U.S. Senate health care plan discussion, Jackie, the Cleveland plain dealer, Cleveland.com, had an interesting story late last week that, you know, as John Kasich is vigorously defending one portion of Obamacare, the Medicaid expansion, his administration is asking for waivers for other parts. Explain what's going on there.
Yeah, the administration is working on a waiver to get out of a couple Obamacare requirements, such as the individual mandate to purchase insurance and the employer mandate. And this actually was not a Kasich idea. It goes back 2 years ago to the last budget, and it's something that lawmakers put in the budget requiring the administration to seek this kind of waiver. And at the time, it was thought that it was a safeguard against there was a Supreme Court case at the time about the individual mandate, and it was seen as a safeguard in case the court ruled differently and they could, you know, have this ready to go as a tool to employ. Well, I mean, the court case was settled, and this was kind of forgotten about. And the other thing about this provision is that you really could not even seek these waivers until 2017. They wanted to give some time for the markets to everything to get kind of up and running before you could try to get out of some of these things. So flash forward now to this year, and the administration did start working on it. They've put out an RFP to find a consultant to help them come up with this back in, I believe, in June. So they're working on it. Meanwhile, lawmakers put some more teeth into this latest budget bill saying, hey, you have to get it done by next January. The thing is, in order to get out of these requirements, you have to have a plan B that says we're not going to see a drop in coverage. We're going to have the same number of people covered if we do this. That's why it's called an innovation waiver. You have to be innovative in how you're going to do this. Well, you know, my colleague Steve Koff in D.C. talked to the Kasich folks. He talked to legislators that worked on this. No one has any plan B. So it's to be determined at this point. But
so is the Kasich administration just going through the motions because state law requires it?
It is a requirement in state law. You know, and there are certainly some supporters, you know, in the Department of Insurance, you know, until recently led by Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, who's been a very strong opponent of Obamacare and specifically the mandates. So I have not, you know, spoken with her about it, but I can imagine that she supports this sort of, you know, waiver to get out of it. Certainly several lawmakers do, and that they put some more teeth in it to say you have to get this done. But, yeah, you know, the position from the Kasich administration is this is what we were directed to do in law, so we're going to do it.
The bottom line is, though, the mandates are in place thanks to the Supreme Court decision and the fact that they haven't repealed Obamacare yet.
Correct.
All right. You know, John Kasich keeps calling for a bipartisan solution to this. That's what he said in his statement, where he said this plan is unacceptable. Daryl, he's been calling for this for quite a while. Are the odds improving of a bipartisan solution for this?
Well, actually, yes, because everything else has gone down the tubes, or appears to be. So, I mean, Mitch McConnell is using this as a threat in his caucus. And this just shows, you know, our friend to the south of the border here. It's like it's been in Washington a long time. We're shocked. We'd have to have a bipartisan solution, Mike.
Yeah.
By golly, if we don't work out a compromise, we're going to have to turn to Democrats. And most of us here in flyover country said, yeah, that's – I mean, I think more people are going to side with John Kasich in that one as opposed to Mitch McConnell. You know, God love him. And, you know, and the Democrats – now, of course, they have nothing to lose. Chuck Schumer, our own Sherrod Brown. Yeah, let's – hey, we're willing to work. First of all, we admit there are problems with Obamacare. We're willing to work. We just get rid of this – this whole tax business, tax cut business, this is a health care bill, and get rid of this, we're going to wipe out Obamacare first. Now, are they bluffing? Are they? Is it just politics? I say, let's call them on their bluff. Say, okay. Senator Brown talked about if he and Senator Portman and a couple of other senators could get in the room, they could solve this thing. And for God's sakes, why wouldn't you say, all right, God bless you, go to it, let's see what you come up with.
Jesse, a political poll shows that 54% of Republicans surveyed – this is Republicans now – 54% surveyed they want Republicans and Democrats to come up with a health care plan. But if you're a Republican like Jim Jordan or even Rob Portman, to compromise with Democrats is really going to turn off your base on Obamacare, correct?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because – I think the more times we introduce a bill and then it goes nowhere and this cycle continues on television and in your newspapers, people are like, oh, gosh, just do something about this. Like, fix it. We all know there's some problems. Let's just address them and move on. So I think there's going to – as this continues, there's going to be some fatigue about talking about healthcare, as fascinating as it is.
Yeah.
So I think you have that going on. But I also think – you know, in general, bipartisanship always sounds like a good idea. The other thing is it sounds like, I mean, both the House and the Senate are probably safe Republicans for at least a couple more years. And so there isn't like a huge you're going to lose your seat if you vote, if you work with Democrats this time. I guess that could come back in the future when there's so many concerns about primaries and being primaried by somebody more conservative than you. But there isn't a huge political risk to working with the other side right now.
Because those districts are still drawn the way they were in 2010.
They are.
We're pretty safe for the most part, although they're, you know.
Well, but they're safe. I mean, and this is sort of the problem with Jeremy. And they're safe from a challenge from the other party.
Yeah.
But it makes you more vulnerable to a challenge within your own party and usually to an extreme from your own party. Democrats from the left, Republicans from the right. So, I mean, this, you know, these guys are so paranoid about reelection. And it's I mean, I just think back to, you know, this, I guess here's my age. I just think back to 72. Why did Nixon and the Republicans even bother breaking into the Watergate? What did they need that was going to make him beat George McGovern anymore?
Yes.
Well, it's never enough
for
a politician. You know, if you win by 99%, why didn't we win by 100? And I'm in danger if I only won by 99%. That's a bit extreme, but I think that's the mentality that I've observed over the years.
Taking nothing for granted anyway. Jackie, what can Democrats give on this? We say that Republicans have to give to form a bipartisan solution. But, you know, what will Democrats have to give up on this? Reforming Medicaid? Medicaid works?
I think that's the big – Medicaid reform, I think, is the big one because, you know, many Republicans see that as an entitlement that has been completely overblown and abused and needs to be reined in. And I think that's the area where they probably would make the most ground with the widest, you know, variety of Republicans, conservative, moderate, you know, all sides. I think the coverage issue is huge. And that's one that where they can find some common ground on, because I think everyone's hearing from their constituents that they don't want less coverage. They don't want, you know, less access to coverage. They like that about Obamacare. And so maybe that's something where they can break some bread together and get it done.
And that's what people have been saying since Obamacare was put in place. You've given these benefits. It's going to be really tough to take them away, which is what the Senate and the House plan does by cutting Medicaid. It's right. You're taking benefits away.
That's right. And we should not, you know, as we justly criticize the, you know, the questionable truthiness, dare we say, of Vice President Pence's statements, of Majority Leader McConnell's maneuverings. There is a truth here that yeah, this stuff is expensive as everything, and something's got to be done. And this is why, you know, both Senator Portman and Governor Kasich have agreed to a more gradual glide path to, yeah, you know, we can't keep funding this Medicaid expansion at, you know, even if it's worse, I think it's 90% into the future. It's like that's just going to break the bank. So something's got to be done. But, you know, until there's a little honesty from the both sides and give up the politics and work toward a solution, you know, I don't know if we're going to see it.
Cost control is the key, mm-hmm. Jasmine. Yeah. You know, I was reading in The New Yorker that, you know, one of the reasons why efforts to impose universal health care back in the 19-teens or 1940s was because the AMA opposed it because doctors were making a good amount of money. And AMA supports this because it's Medicaid expansion increases the insurance pool. Hospitals don't have to pay for free coverage anymore. But there are no cost controls on, quote, unnecessary medical treatments or prescription drugs or things like that.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the great concerns with Medicaid expansion is it is moving towards that universal health care. And this is a population that, you know, obviously is lower income, but also presumably able-bodied. And, you know, it's not those who have a disability or those who are, you know, children or so forth. So moving towards this direction, I think, has some conservatives just, you know, terrified and the costs associated therein. So that's why it's so problematic.
Yeah. And the cost control is the big elephant in the room. I mean, that's not addressed in any of these bills. And that's still, you know, costs are still increasing under Obamacare, too. There's very little done there. And, you know, I think that that's one of those areas where they could probably find some common ground on and come out. But
then you lose in
this imaginary meeting of the bipartisan minds that we're talking about.
Well, as the Clintons found out in the 90s, then you lose the doctors and the insurance companies that, you know, where money is being made. And they don't want to give that up at this point or if ever.
Yeah, that's why this isn't easy. And again, Governor Kasich, you listen to him on the presidential campaign trail, and his main criticism of Obamacare was it didn't control costs. You know, costs continued to skyrocket. And again, a lot of people blame that on Obamacare. Well, I think we can all remember back before Obamacare, it wasn't like health care was cheap and the price was stable.
Yeah, the Obamacare argument.
We're trying various solutions for various parties, and it's like, you know, they've all got problems. So.
Yeah, the Obamacare argument is, prices are going up, just not as fast as they were before Obamacare, which is, you know, it's true, but not terribly helpful if you see your premiums going up every year and your deductibles increasing every year.
And as you alluded to, it's just very hard to take away things that people are getting used to having. You know, maybe you hate Obamacare, but you really like that your kid can be on your insurance until 26, or gosh, you really didn't like that former president, but you really enjoy the fact that your, you know, pre-existing conditions are covered. And I also think a situation that we may run into is some of the people in these Republican districts are benefiting from Medicaid expansion, but perhaps don't know it or, you know, won't really be truly upset about losing it until it's not there.
Yeah, that is kind of we're still talking about a fairly small portion of the American public that is directly affected by this. We're talking in Ohio, this, you know, 700,000 people took advantage of Medicaid, 200,000 people are on the exchange through Obamacare. So about a million people out of a state of 12 million. Most of the rest of us get our insurance through our employers, through Medicare. What is the impact on us here in this room who get our insurance through our employer? I mean, there is a macro that, you know, the hospital costs are less because of Medicaid. How do we get people who are not directly impacted by this to care?
Well, I think that's part of it. And, you know, just having a healthier state with healthier people in it, I would hope would be of general concern. Now, maybe that's a little too esoteric. But you're right. If people can stop using the emergency room for, you know, a doctor's routine doctor's checkup, I think that'll help all of us. You know, we might only have to wait a couple hours rather than 4 hours or something. You know, sorry hospitals, but I've been there.
Yeah, but if it keeps the cost down, you'd hope that it would keep your insurance premiums down and your prescription drug costs down, but. You know, we haven't quite seen it yet.
I think it goes back to the cost control that there has been little, you know, done there. And that's the frustration from a lot of middle class people who, you know, bought on the exchanges or, you know, have private insurance where they see their premiums going up and up, and they don't see like seem like they're getting the bang, you know, for their buck in return.
All right. We are talking with our reporter roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann Fisher today. When we come back, we'll put healthcare aside for the moment and we'll talk a little Ohio politics, you know, a few developments in the race for governor and U.S. Senate. And we're looking ahead to 2020 when All Sides with Ann Fisher continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann this morning. Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor wants to replace her boss in 2018. That makes her the fourth Republican candidate to officially enter the race for governor. Of course, the GOP field is crowded with some big names. Mary Taylor, the lieutenant governor, joins Secretary of State John Husted, Attorney General Mike DeWine, and Congressman Jim Renacci. Still with us to discuss this political news and other State House and political developments, Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, state government reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Balmert, and public affairs editor with the Columbus Dispatch, Daryl Rowland. Jesse, we'll start with you. Mary Taylor, it's been about a week now since she formally announced her bid for governor. She's been laying the groundwork for months. How closely can she run with John Kasich? Can she hitch her wagon to John Kasich and run as John Kasich's third term and win the GOP primary?
It'll be interesting. I think all of these candidates are going to be somewhere. They're going to have to deal with their relationship with John Kasich and Donald Trump, who are the two most influential Republican politicians in the state right now. And so Mary Taylor has the advantage of being the lieutenant governor. I mean, John Kasich has said all along that if Mary Taylor gets in the race that she would be his pick because he supported her back when he was a bit of an unknown in politics when he ran for governor the first time. And so that's certainly to her advantage, especially with those who still like John Kasich's policies. But there are also Republicans who are just, you know, frustrated with him poking the president all of the time. And so that's not going to win her any fans there. But it's not like Mary Taylor and John Kasich have the same opinions on everything. She famously was opposed to Medicaid expansion, which is something that obviously he is defending a lot right now. So I think her, like everyone else in the GOP field, is going to have to say, you know, here's where I'm like John Kasich and here's where I'm going to diverge from him.
Jackie, I mean, is that really where she can separate herself from the governor? Is the Medicaid expansion and Obamacare? You mentioned earlier she was a fierce critic.
Yeah, I mean, she's been able to remain a fierce critic despite some of the decisions that Kasich has made, and you know, she made that point during her announcement at the City Club that she doesn't, you know, she respects Kasich and the decisions he makes, but doesn't agree with him 100% of the time, just like her husband, which I think a lot of people can identify with.
Yep.
But, you know, look, we don't have to look far back to see this happen, you know, last year with Rob Portman. Everyone was like, how is he going to, you know, is he going to endorse Trump and is he going to support him? He's going to go to the RNC. And he was able to kind of straddle that line where he officially endorsed Trump, but he didn't go, you know, above and beyond to hitch his wagon to him. And he did just fine.
Daryl, how does this race break out? I mean, you have three statewide office holders, have been statewide office holders for at least the past 8 years, longer than that for some, for all, really. And you have Jim Renacci, congressman from Northeast Ohio, Trump, big Trump supporter. How does this race break out?
Well, I think as Jackie and Jesse have both pointed out, at some point, all four of these candidates are going to have to state their relationship and their feelings about the positions of Governor John Kasich and President Donald Trump. Congressman Renacci has been the most vocal candidate to cast himself at least as you know, in the Trump mold, if you will. And he is running as, you know, I'm over here. I'm not a longtime state office holder. So that's what makes me unique, you know. And Mike DeWine, who is the longest serving office holder, will tout that experience and over his opponents. And again, as was pointed out, Mary Taylor did the kind of a dance in her official announcement. She did not mention John Kasich by name at all. and only made one passing reference to him. Well, that was like the first or one of the first questions from the audience afterwards. To her credit, she took questions after her announcement speech, which the other three, to my knowledge, did not.
Yeah, I thought that was really I thought that was really admirable, that to have your campaign announcement in an uncontrolled environment. I mean, talk about politicians, Daryl, who always want to have control and don't take nothing for granted. Here she was taking questions from Jim Renacci supporters or Donald Trump supporters.
Yeah, she definitely, I think, deserves some credit for that. The others, well, Mike DeWine officially announced at his ice cream social, which, you know, it's all his friends, family and people who are interested in supporting his candidacy. But I think, you know, some of the other ones, they roll out these, you know,
YouTube videos
with scenes from, you know, around the state. And I think, going to the City Club in Cleveland, that's very real and totally taking a risk. So
yeah, John Husted was wearing lots of flannel shirts and carrying lots of guns in his video.
Yeah.
Of course, they don't allow guns in the City Club, I don't think, anyway. So open carry or not. So
yeah, I think with four Republican candidates and three of them statewide office holders, I mean, I think you just have to take whatever small piece of the electorate you can grab and really bolster that point. And obviously money is going to be huge. But Renacci, I find interesting because he's kind of campaigning as like a Columbus outsider, whereas, you know, he's still kind of like a Washington insider. So it's interesting to me. I think he is kind of cleaving towards the Trump message, but, you know, make no mistake, he's not Donald Trump, and he's not going to be able to run the same race that Trump did.
But Trump can appear in his ads, and that should help.
Well, that's one of the intriguing questions here. I mean, we know Casey's going to be helping Mary Taylor, at least to some degree, although, again, you got to watch how obvious that is, because that could end up hurting her. Will President Trump weigh in? I mean, just look back at January. He is calling individual Ohio residents to influence the party chairman selection. You would think governor may even be more important. And he's got to want to remove a thorn in his side from the state of Ohio.
Yeah.
And the second in command at the RNC is Bob Poduchik, who was the campaign manager for Trump in Ohio. So, yes, I think Trump will have his fingers in the Ohio gubernatorial race.
So does that mean that Jim Renacci stays till the end? Because there's some thought that one of these big names will run for something else. But Jim Renacci, you know, he's a wealthy businessman. If he lost his congressional seat, which he would if he ran and won, you know, or lost, he can't run for both offices at the same time. He's in to stay. He's the Trump candidate to stay, would you say?
Jackie? I think so. I mean, he can afford it too.
Yeah.
You know, he's got the wealth to personally finance his campaign. You know, Mike DeWine could probably do the same. The others, you know, fundraising is going to be a big part of that race going forward. And by positioning himself as the Columbus outsider, you know, he can continue with the case that he doesn't need the Columbus funding from the Columbus donors to, you know, continue to fight for what he is standing for.
Speaking of fundraising, Sherrod Brown announced last week that he's raised $2.6 million in the last 3 months. That was really record level. It broke the record from the previous 3 months where he raised $2.4 million. So he has got, I think, around $6 million in the bank facing Josh Mandel. This Senate race is likely going to be very expensive. Daryl, what does that say about $5 million in basically 6 months for Sherrod Brown?
It's amazing when you think about it, isn't it? And
yeah,
the calls that were made and all that, the extent of the effort. And when we say record, we should say that's an off-election year record for a quarter. Like next year, his quarterly totals will probably, you know, dwarf that. You know, that's good. That certainly shows his support. This is going to be a nationally watched race. But because that's the fact, perhaps just as important is going to be the outside money that comes into this. I mean, 6 years ago, tens of millions of dollars.
We'll just look at Portman and Strickland a couple years ago.
Right. And that wasn't really that competitive of a race in the stretch run, certainly. The Democrats kind of abandoned the former governor. If Josh Mandel can keep close in the polls, which, you know, he only lost by, 6 points last time around. And again, if he gets help from Trump people, this could become kind of a little surrogate battle as well. But the dark money and stuff, this is going to be expensive and, dare I say it, a dirty race.
Well, in 2012, I mean, the dark money is what really, you know, kept that race alive. And it was heavily on Josh Mandel's side against Sherrod Brown. I mean, I remember those ads were running very, very early in the season. And I'm sure we'll just in a couple months, we'll start seeing them again. You know, the ones that don't tell you vote for Josh Mandel, but say, you know, call Senator Brown and tell him he's doing a terrible job in Washington.
Yeah, the issue ads.
The issue, yes. The issue educational ads. And I expect that to be the case this time. So, you know, Senator Brown is going to need that arsenal of the, you know, direct contributions to try and beat that back.
Jesse Ballmer. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. And also to the point of it being so close last time, it was also a presidential election year. And, you know, Sherrod had the benefit of having Barack Obama on the ticket as well. So I think that's where the Mandel camp sees an opportunity to really close that gap.
Now, Jesse, Josh Mandel's primary opponent, Mike Gibbons, businessman from the Cleveland area, his campaign raised $600,000. We were joking off air that it was larger than expected because we didn't know what to expect. So $600,000, is that going to do enough to make a little dent and run a few ads against Josh Mandel in the primary? Or is that just a drop in the bucket?
It's sad because when you think about that money, just if it was in your personal budget, it seems like a massive sum. But
yeah, I'd love to have $600,000.
You could buy a nice house.
I would like $600,000. But in a race like this where, like you just mentioned, Sherrod Brown raised $2.6 million, it really is just a drop in the bucket. And I think his own email was like more than expected. So I think that's where Gibbons is trying to come in and say, like, look, there are people who don't like Josh Mandel. And I mean, that's something we knew going into this. So I guess if he could chip away a little bit, but I just don't see him as a legitimate competitor to Mandel in this primary.
He could bloody him up, though. I mean, it's not bad. I mean, it's not like he's a, you know, some flake who has absolutely, you know, no credibility as a candidate. And Josh Mandel is very unpopular in some Republican circles. And, you know, if the Governor Kasich's supporters are so inclined, you know, they want to sort of mess things up for Josh Mandel. Wouldn't be a stretch to see that in this state. Mm-hmm. You know, they could make it interesting. I'm not saying that Josh Mandel's going to lose, but it could make it interesting.
And $600,000 is—it's not chump change. It's a good amount of money, and it might just—he's saying, "Look, I can raise money, mm-hmm. so now you can join the campaign and say, look, I can raise money. I'm going to have a legitimate race. It's of some level anyway."
Yeah, and I think in a field, kind of going back to the governor's race, but in a field with so many candidates, showing that you can raise money is going to be able to kind of separate you from other people, especially on the Democrat side where there's no particularly clear front runner. And so, you know, raising money certainly shows seriousness in these types of races.
Getting back to that $5 million that Sherrod Brown has raised in the last 6 months, Darrell, does it show a little bit of Democratic enthusiasm for this upcoming midterm election, and that, you know, they're emboldened by Hillary Clinton's defeat and Donald Trump's, you know, presidency, that they are willing to start putting money down now?
I mean, I think you could make that case. Obviously, we can't read the donors' minds. But yeah, a lot of Democrats are saying, man, we can't wait till this midterm election. And yeah, it's certainly a sign of credibility. And you know, Sherrod Brown is one who's never been he's been a populist. He's never been afraid to shy away from that liberal label that so many of the progressives go by these days. You know, he's unabashed. He's unashamed of that. So he's kind of a purist in that way, and a lot of Democrats like that.
And he has the populist streak, and he's very much opposed to trade deals and NAFTA, much in the Donald Trump mode. So
right, and it was, I think, seriously considered to be Hillary Clinton's running mate last year.
We're talking about Ohio politics. Just a few minutes left in the weekly roundtable here at All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Joining me, Jackie Borchard from Cleveland.com, Jesse Ballmer from the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Dal Rowland from the Columbus Dispatch. I read today, I think it was Cleveland.com, in their political roundup, that Tim Ryan, Congressman Tim Ryan from Youngstown, is going to New Hampshire. And there is speculation that he may run for president in 2020. To which I said, Jackie, really?
Everyone goes to New Hampshire, right? Before.
Well, it is beautiful this time of year.
It is. Actually, lakes, if I were going to go to New Hampshire, you know, this would be the time to go, or in the fall, you know, when the leaves are changing. But no, I mean, in all seriousness, look at John Kasich. I mean, that's where he started out in New Hampshire. That's where he put all or most of his eggs in that basket and kind of built a network there. So, you know, when you see someone going there a couple of years ahead of an election, certainly that's the conclusion that you jump to. But he did say, you know, he kind of skirted around the presidential question, but he did say that he doesn't plan to challenge Leader Pelosi again after losing to her.
He does not plan to challenge.
Does not plan. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I don't know, Mike. Mount Washington, Lake Winnipesaukee, they're really nice this time of year.
It is. Steve Stevens was just there. Was in the yesterday's
paper.
It
was.
The travel writer from the Dispatch. You went to the top of Mount Washington. I've been there. It's terrific. Maybe that's what
great
it is.
Great views.
I'm sure that's all there is to it.
So, I mean, he did challenge Nancy Pelosi, made a bit of a name for himself. He is this, like Sherrod Brown, a populist Democrat from a Northeast Ohio, Youngstown area. Could a person like that, maybe not president, be a vice presidential candidate, perhaps? Granted, he's still a congressman. Only one represents one district, one of 435.
Yeah, that certainly sparks, you know, some national attention and people looking at him. And actually, I believe he's going to speak to like a young Democrats club or convention or conference or something. So, you know, that's a sign that if the younger, you know, party faithful are saying, hey, this guy is a rising star, could be a rising star, then you know, that's a good sign for him.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. On the other hand, it's like Tim Ryan, seemingly the great mentioner, as we call him in journalism, always gets, quote unquote, mentioned for all of these races, whether it's governor, the U.S. Senate, or whatever. And it's like, Tim, dude, you're the old quarterback. Throw the ball or, you know, take the sack.
Yeah.
I mean, just how many months ago his name was being floated for governor? Will he, won't he? That's kind of always the question. It's always won't.
It is always won't. I guess in his limited, he has been trying to raise his national profile a little bit, I think, you know, challenging Pelosi. And then also he wrote, like, maybe it was Medium, or he wrote a letter recently about how Democrats' stock was basically worse than Donald Trump's right now after the loss in Georgia, Ossoff. So I think he is getting his name out there more and more. But will he pull the trigger? I mean, historically, no.
I mean, he does offer certainly a perspective from Trump country. That area went from Democrat to many supporters of Donald Trump. So I think the Democrats probably should listen to that perspective at least.
And there's more than just president. If you become a figure on the national stage, you can get a cabinet appointment. You can run for a higher office at some point, perhaps House leadership positions, things like that.
Oh, sure.
Speaking of 2020, apparently Columbus plans to bid, according to the Columbus Dispatch, plans to bid on the 2020 Democratic Convention. Of course, in 2016, it lost out on both conventions. They put a bid in for both the Democratic and Republican national conventions, and it didn't happen. Daryl, any better chance in 2020 than they had in 2016?
Well, you know, Columbus did make the finals
in
2016 with among the Democrats. Now, Philadelphia eventually won. Brooklyn was the other final. So, you know, you're in the final three. Sometimes you have to have a go at these things and get familiar with working on that national level. They had some really interesting, sophisticated plans about how they would move people and, you know, house people at Ohio State. And
they're building more hotels downtown.
I was going to say. And the convention support infrastructure that, you know, really precluded any serious bid for Columbus years ago is now really getting there.
Still need direct flights, though, right?
Yeah, flights and transportation from the airport, I think, is still a big question mark.
Yeah, Cleveland was bopped a little bit for having too few direct flights, and somehow they made it work.
Uh-huh. Did Columbus get much feedback when it lost the bid last time about why they didn't?
I talked to people and they did some. I think part of it was, you know, Philadelphia's kind of a more traditional city. But, you know, the people in Columbus say, look at Cleveland. They were housing delegates like in Sandusky. Yeah. We didn't have anyone outside the Outer Belt. I mean, like, aside from the hotels at Polaris and at the Outer Belt. So, hey, we'll see. Who
knows? We shall see. All right. Thanks to Jackie Borchard from Cleveland.com, Jesse Balmert from the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Dal Rowland from the Columbus Dispatch. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.